School District versus Dolph. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is William Pratt and I represent the appellant, the Renton School District. I'd like to please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Well.
The March 27, 2012 closing order was final and binding 60 days after it was communicated to respondent Dolph in September of 2012 by Ms. Stanfill. I would like to begin by talking first about the service requirement of RCW 51-52050 and then move on to talk about the communication requirement under RCW 51-52060. 51-52050 provides, the plain language of the statute provides, that the department is to mail notices and orders to parties at their last known address on file with the department.
Do you agree first that the statute creates a mandate that the department mail to the employee? And there is, it's required.
I concede, Your Honor, that the statute mandates that both that the department mail the document and it also mandates the manner in which that mailing is to occur. And that is to the last known address on file with the department.
And it's your position that if they mail to the last known address, that's it. Even if they find out it's the wrong address, that's good.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we tie those two together? If the department has a mandate to mail to the employee, and they mail to someplace else, how do we fulfill the statutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's a couple points. First, the service of the document, the valid service of the document by the department is not what triggers the 60-day appeal period. And so this condition, I would argue, reflects a bit of a compromise. By the department's own admission in their response brief, stated that the department serves hundreds of thousands of orders per year, presumably with more than one party. So that's a tremendous volume of these documents. And the statute provides that the department mail these documents according to their own records. And this is an efficiency concern. It's impractical for the department to independently verify the mailing address.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about independent. But if they're notified, as in this case, promptly, that there is a wrong address and they're given the right address, we let the department off?
In this case, Your Honor, I don't think there was any bias or any prejudice to the respondent by this document being mailed to the last known address on record. And in fact, while there was a letter from the Walthu law firm stating that it was the wrong address, there are two concerns that I would argue are presented with that. First is that document was a hearsay document, and that was provided by the Walthu law firm themselves. Second, I would like to underscore that in the testimony of Ms. Jones, the respondent Dolph did not elicit from Ms. Jones a verification that there was no change of address form in the record. And so it's a little bit nebulous as to whether or not that change of address form was ever filed, changing Mr. Dolph's address to that of the Walthu law firm.
I think I heard you say that 60 days began to run after Ms. Stanfill gave you notice?
After the order was communicated by Ms. Stanfill, yes.
But it also, I thought I just heard you say that the fact that they mailed it to their last known address was sufficient. So that's when the 60 days ran. So which is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I sounded like I was arguing that is not correct.
But if the department did what they were supposed to do by mailing it to the last known address, why wouldn't that be the effective date?
Your Honor, if the department had mailed that document to the correct address, the actual address possessed by the claimant, that would have then communicated the order. That is true. However, In this case, I would propose that the legislature had a separate statute, which is the 060 statute, that requires that the order be communicated in order for that statute to begin to run. And that's consistent with the plain language of RCW 51-52050 that allows the document to rely on its own records. Quite fairly presumed that that's in recognition of the tremendous volume of orders that are being generated every year by the department. By adding that communication requirement, that then protects the parties. It doesn't, their appeal period doesn't even begin to run until they receive the document. There's no compelling argument coming from the respondents, we would argue, for requiring only the department to be the one to be able to effectively communicate this order, especially in the context of a self-insured claim. During a state fund claim, the standard operating procedure is for the workers or their attorneys to secure the claim files or documents from the claim files from the department, and therefore that the department would be able to communicate those orders at that time. However, in a self-insured claim, it's standard operating procedure for claimants or workers to secure claim files from the self-insured employer's third-party administrator, in this case the claim manager, Ms. Stanfill. And so it stands to reason that in this particular case, the order being communicated by Ms. Stanfill was indeed appropriate, as the self-insured employer's claims administrator was effectively standing in the shoes of the department, as it often does in various other contexts during a workers' compensation claim. I would also point out that the plain language of RCW 51-52060 does not provide that the communication be affected by any particular individual or party. The legislature had every opportunity to use different language other than communicated to the worker or communicated to the party, I believe the language is. They did no such thing. And I would also hearken back to the Rodriguez case, Rodriguez v. Department of Labor and Industries, in which the Supreme Court held that communication is effective upon receipt. And there was no language in Rodriguez to suggest that service by the department was necessary prerequisite to effective communication. Real quickly, I would like to also nod back to the 1927 Supreme Court Nafis case, in which the court held that communication of the order was effective when the notice was put in the robe of the worker who was in the hospital at that time. I think it's significant here that it's unlikely that the worker had changed his address with the department to that of the hospital, given the nature of what was occurring there. However, the department the Supreme Court found it effective communication when that note was put in the bathrobe of the claimant hanging next to his bed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court, my name is Steve Vineyard. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Department of Labor and Industries. The Department and Mr. Dolph's counsel will each be taking 5 minutes. The Department's closing order did not become final.
You have 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Let me make the adjustment then. Go ahead.
Thank you. The Department's closing order did not become final and binding because it was not properly communicated to Mr. Dolph. This Court should affirm the Board and the Superior Court's decision in that regard for two reasons. First, RCW 51-52050 requires the Department, not the employer or another party, to serve the Department's orders on injured workers. Second, delivering an order to a law firm that does not represent a worker does not communicate the order to that worker. First, the department's closing order did not become final based on the employer's informal mailing of the order to Mr. Dolph, because the statute requires the department to serve its orders on the affected parties, including the worker, and it does not provide for service by another party. The statute states that the department shall promptly serve its orders on workers, employers, and other affected parties, and that it serve them by mail. It gives detailed instructions on what notice the department is to give in its orders and how it is to deliver them. So when the statute then continues to state that the employer, the worker, has the recipients have a 60-day deadline to file an appeal, it's making that statement in the context of the legislature's understanding that the department is the one that served the order. And furthermore, so when you read those two statutes together, the conclusion is that the deadline to file an appeal is not triggered unless the department serves the parties with the order.
I think the suggestion is that the department has such volume in terms of these notices that other means may be contemplated if it successfully communicates to the worker that his case has been closed. You disagree?
I disagree. I mean, it's certainly true that the department communicates many, many orders, but I don't think it follows that what the legislature was trying to do here is create the sort of two-part system where all the department has to do is mail it to the address shown in its records, and then as long as the worker got it, it doesn't matter how the worker got it, any method of the worker getting it is good enough to trigger the deadline. I don't see any basis in the statute to conclude that that was the legislature's purpose. Rather, I think the most reasonable reading of the statute is that the legislature directed the department to mail orders, directed the department how it was to do that, and then provided that the parties have 60 days to appeal once they receive it from the department. I would further note that the statute does not provide for any sort of alternate service. If the legislature had intended to allow for that, it could have easily done it.
Any sort of substantial compliance doctrine that you're aware of that would apply in these circumstances?
I guess I would say, first, I'm not aware of a case addressing that issue. And usually when there's an issue of substantial compliance in workers' comp cases, it's someone filed an appeal that does not fully comply with what the appeal is supposed to do, not the other way around. So I'm not aware of a case recognizing substantial compliance. I would say that if the department mailed an order to a worker, there was a harmless error of some kind in the department's notice, such as the wrong zip code, but the worker did in fact receive it and received it from the department, I think certainly an argument could be made in that case that that's a harmless error, and that there was either substantial compliance or otherwise that was enough to trigger the deadline. But here we don't just have a typo. We have the department sent the order to a law firm that had never appeared on the worker's behalf and had never filed a notice of representation. And I would note the employer seems to be arguing this issue de novo, but the Superior Court found that there was no notice of representation by the law firm. There was no request that the worker, from either the worker or the employer, that orders be sent to this law firm on the worker's behalf. And I think the Superior Court's finding is supported by substantial evidence. That's what the worker testified to. That's what the paralegal letter from the law firm stated. The employer argues that that's hearsay, but I think that's neither here nor there. The document was admitted. It was admitted without objection, and it's the only evidence that clearly addresses whether there was a representation or not. And so I think it's improper. Yes, Your Honor.
How about the school district's argument that 060, if we read it the way they would like us to read it, it sets up a compromise. And here we had almost a two-year gap between Mr. Dolph receiving the notice from the school district and him actually filing an appeal.
Right.
So how about that?
Well, I don't think the legislature was trying to create a compromise. It was trying to create a two-part system where the department sends things to its address on file and the worker just has to receive it and it doesn't matter how. I think the most reasonable reading of the statute is that the legislature intended all this to be read together, that the department has to mail it, the department has to follow certain procedures, and then when it does, there's 60 days to file an appeal. I guess I'll put it this way. I don't see a basis for concluding that the legislature's plan was to set some sort of compromise. But the department requests that the court affirm. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Alden Bird on behalf of the respondent, Daniel Dolph. And I'd like to use my time to address a couple of the points Mr. Pratt raised. And first, I'd like to start with the substantial compliance question that Your Honor's raised. There is no provision in the case law, in the statute, for substantial compliance. And in fact, reviewing the case law, I think it's clear that the courts have strictly interpreted the notice requirements. Rodriguez, in particular, that the employer is relying on, wasn't concerned with whether the worker understood the order, whether the worker had any knowledge of the actual contents of the order. The communication itself was enough. But that was communication from the department itself. And I would argue that if the court is going to hold to such strict compliance with the notice requirements of the order in terms of the workers' protest rights, it should apply the same strict compliance with the actual statute that sets out how those orders are supposed to be served on workers and doesn't allow for some sort of alternate service. The employer is essentially arguing that A, defective service because it never actually got to the worker, and B, service from or a mailing from the salvage employer somehow combined together to equal some effective communication of the worker's the decision regarding the worker's claim and his notice and appeal rights. And I think this case specifically kind of exemplifies what happens and the sort of mischief that comes about there. Mr. Dolph's benefits were cut off in March of 2012. He didn't even know this. I mean, he knew he wasn't receiving benefits, but he never got any communication from the department about that. So he didn't learn his claim was actually closed until July, when he had a phone conversation with the claims manager, who at that time told him his only option was to file a reopening application. Now, there's no there's a 7-year deadline for filing reopening applications, so I don't know how the employer expected him to proceed with that information when he's under the impression that his closure is already final and binding. So when he finally does get that order in December, it's an order addressed to an SIE that says you have 60 days from the date this is communicated to you. The order's dated March 27. How he's supposed to put that together and recognize, well, I have 60 days from today to protest that, I'm not sure. And that's exactly the prejudice that we're talking about, that the employer's not recognizing here, that the injured worker, he did wait almost a year to file a reopening application. That's what he did. He filed a reopening application. He didn't file a protest because he thought he couldn't. And I really want to go back to, as well, the argument that somehow the Walthrop Law Firm address was the last known address in the department's records. And I think the employer is passing over some critical words there. It's not just the last address in the department records, it's the last known address. It has to actually be an address that is known of the claimants. It's something that the claimant told them, that's where I received mail, or I authorize you to send mail to that location. Otherwise, the department could just pick an address out of a hat and mail it, and if that's what their records show, at least under the employer's argument, then that's effective service of the order. And then,
so if he had received the order, he would have known that he had the right to protest?
Yes, if he had received it, at least the court would assume he knew he had the right to protest, and it would be reasonable.
Well, I mean, the notice would have told him that.
That's correct, yes. The notice, the order would have contained the appropriate
language
advising of the 60 days to protest or appeal that order. But, you know, under the employer reasoning, as long as the department puts it in the mail to an address, and then at some point in the future the worker gets the order, then he's...
So where did this last known law firm address come from?
The Walthrop Law Firm address?
Yeah.
So it was a mistake on the part of the department, and they've admitted that they made a mistake. Mr. Dolph pursued representation with the Walthrop Law Firm, and what standard practice in workers' comp is, give us permission to access your file, we'll review your file and identify whether we want to represent you. And that's distinct from advising the department that we are now representing this worker, and then you should mail all correspondence.
So was there some other address in the file other than the law firm?
Yes, the department had Mr. Dahl's home address, and that was the address on file the entire time until that brief March period when they erroneously changed the address to the Walthrop Law Firm.
So if they had used the address that was on file, we wouldn't have this appeal.
Exactly. That's correct. And the prejudice to Mr. Dolph is significant. We're here now 5 years later, and he's still contesting his ability to protest that closure. His claim is still closed as of March 2012. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to just tackle a couple quick points. There's some concern that Mr. Dolph wasn't apprised of his appeal rights when he received those orders from Ms. Stanfill. However, there's evidence in the record that might suggest that he was apprised of his rights. Mr. Dolph.
Well, are you making the argument that there's not substantial evidence to support the court's findings?
Your Honor, I believe that this is a question of law and that the facts, be them as they may, even if we take all the facts as the claimant, would, Mr. Dolph would have us believe them, the claimant still cannot prevail as a matter of law here.
Okay, and so why is that?
That's because the department abided by the clear, distinct language of the statute when serving the order. I would even argue that it's not, that the proper service by the department isn't a prerequisite to the triggering of this appeal period. However, that's not at issue here because the department did abide by the plain language of RCW 51.
By mailing.
By mailing it to the last known address on record with the department.
Even if the known address is not an address that was given to them by the claimant?
Even if that was the case, Your Honor, yes. As I was saying earlier, I would like to just nod back to the point that the tremendous volume of documents that's whirling through the department every year, hundreds of thousands of orders being issued, clerical errors, administrative errors are inevitable. Those are going to happen. And it makes a lot of sense to have the communication.
And when they do happen, the burden should be borne by the claimant?
The burden isn't borne by the claimant until the claimant receives the order, Your Honor, according to the language of Gonzalez and other cases that have affirmed that. So the
error. This order he received after the 60 days had run?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
He received his notice after the 60 days had run. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. However, there's evidence, testimony by Mr. Dolph, that he had sought assistance from, I think he said dozens or a dozen attorneys upon receiving that copy of that closing order, seeking assistance from attorneys. The Walthy Law Firm, to touch on
you
the...
You think that is there with some evidence that they advised him that the 60 days actually began to run after he spoke with Ms. Stanfill, or
the presumption? The presumption, Your Honor, would be that if he's consulting with attorneys regarding his claim that he's going to be discussing that closing order, which was such a point of contention that he would become so inflamed with Ms. Stanfill on his first contact with her. And about the Walthy Law Firm, you know, the respondent, Dolph, talks about how the Walthy Law Firm had requested records. Well, they requested them once in 2011, and they requested them from the department also in 2013. In 2012, the Walthy Law Firm expressly directed the conduct of the claimant to seek these documents from Ms. Stanfill. So there's clearly an active role being played by Walthy as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next case, RMG Worldwide LLC versus Pierce County.